Let's get corrupted. What is going on, everybody? It's your boy Joe with Meteoric Serpents coming back at you for another episode of the Clurid Corruption Podcast. Guys, I hope you're all doing super well. This is not a live episode. So whenever you're watching this, this was recorded a few days before this gets put out. But I was super excited for this episode. I've been looking forward to having this guest on for quite some time, and I'm glad we were able to make the time for this, especially with time accommodations for difference in time zones. But super excited. We have on Dr. Kevin Messenger, who, if you don't know, we're going to be talking plenty about it, wrote this fantastic book a few years ago, The Asian Rat Snakes and Kin of Greater China. I got that book when it came out, so super, super glad to have him on the show today and just really looking forward to this episode. But let's get through all the basic intro stuff and we'll bring him right on. For those of you watching on YouTube, thank you. Make sure you leave a like on today's podcast. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Feel free to hit that notification bell so you know every single time a new podcast is going live or is coming out or any other videos I drop on the channel. I appreciate that. You could also listen to this podcast on all the major audio platforms like Apple, Spotify, YouTube Music, everything like that. Feel free to give it a 5-star review on there. And yeah, all that good stuff. Make sure you follow me on all the, you know, major social media platforms. It's pretty much at Meteoric Serpents everywhere for those who don't follow me. Go ahead and do that. You know, follow me on Instagram. Let me know how you like the show. Leave a comment too on these. I always like, the podcast feedback. So go ahead and do that. Make sure you guys support USARC, USARC Florida, the organizations that fight for our rights to keep our reptiles, fight against legislation that wants to take away our rights for keeping our reptiles. So make sure you go ahead and do that. The first link in the description below does go to the Meteoric Serpents Patreon. It's a way for you to get a little more behind the scenes access of, one, what I'm doing. Two, it's a way to say thank you for the show. And it keeps you in the loop of everything going on here. You get early access for pre-recorded episodes like this. The Patreon members get this, a few days earlier than the rest of the public. So that's always fun too. And yeah. And we also, as always, are brought to you by the Show Me Reptiles show on the Show Me Marketplace. Guys, whether you're an attender or a vendor, or attendee or a vendor of reptiles shows across the country, make sure you go check out Show Me Reptiles website to go find out where the nearest show is to you. And then while you're at it, if you're a seller of reptiles, check out the Show Me Marketplace, and you can use code corruption-50 to get 50% off your first year's membership on the Show Me Marketplace. That's corruption-50. That's in the description of the podcast as well. And I totally forgot to prep this quickly. The hashtag Kluber Corruption of the Week. Let's check out what's on here. See if we can find some good stuff. Okay, cool. Found it. Hashtag Kluber Corruption of the Week is going to Mike over at Solid Serpents, a nice little big Japanese rat snake here. Just a nice looking animal. Go check out at Solid Serpents on Instagram. That is your hashtag Kluber Corruption of the Week. If you're interested in getting featured, I do one of these weekly. Just put hashtag Kluber Corruption on your Kluber photos on Instagram. And yeah, guys, that is pretty much it. So really, without further ado, let's bring our guest on for tonight and welcome Dr. Messenger to Kluber Corruption. What's up? How are you?
Thanks. My voice is a little off, so I still have a little bit of a sore throat. So my for those that know me, I might sound a little bit off. But
no worries.
I apologize if my voice cracks or anything like that.
No, you're all good, man. Last week I was sick and doing the podcast live, and I know how it feels. Like, I was really sick and did not feel well. So, no, I totally get it. But I do appreciate you taking the time out to do this, truly, especially like we talked about, you know, obviously that with the time difference and us trying to coordinate when it would work for the both of us. Yeah, but I do appreciate you doing that. For anyone who doesn't really know about you or who you are, would you mind giving a little bit of a background about yourself, how you got to where you are today in your career and everything you do?
Sure. Let me think about how to speed it up as much as possible. I'm from North Carolina, from Charlotte, North Carolina. I did my undergrad at NC State. Did my master's in West Virginia. I did my PhD in Alabama. Well, I did one of my PhDs in Alabama. While doing my PhD work in Alabama, I was doing field work every summer in China. And about 2 years, 2 to 3 years into that program, the Chinese university that we're collaborating with, you know, said, simply mentioned, Kevin, you're coming to China every summer, you're doing all this work. If you enroll in our university, take a couple of extra classes, you can also get a PhD from our university as well. And so when you graduate, you can have basically two PhDs. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. So I enrolled in their university. And then in 2017, graduated from Alabama in May, flew to China in June, graduated from my Chinese university in June. In July, I was offered a position from both universities, one in the US and one in China. But the China gig was way above anything that the US gig could have offered. Okay. So I accepted the China job for the fall of 2017. And starting in 2018, spring semester 2018, I was a professor here at Nanjing Forestry University. And so that's kind of like where I am now. Of course, you know, the backstory as to how I got into China is a whole another long, long story. But okay. If you want to talk about that, we can.
No, not necessarily, but no, cool for people to kind of hear your background of what you do. But where did the love for like even reptiles in general start, and how did that get fostered, especially into, you know, getting your PhDs and writing something like this? Like, obviously, you know, you have to be super passionate to be able to write a great book like this and go to school all that time for it as well.
As for herps, or just getting into herps, my recollection of my very first snake was when I was 3 years old. I looked in the back of my dad's truck, and there was a 15-foot Indian rock python. And I just immediately fell in love with it because at that time, you know, kids, we all like dinosaurs and dragons. And at that time, seeing that snake, that was the most resemblance to a dinosaur or a dragon that I had seen in little kids' books. And so I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. As for how that ended up in the back of my dad's truck, my dad is an emergency vet, and the circus was in town, and their Indian rock python had a respiratory tract infection. And so they brought it into his clinic to get some medicine or to get rehabilitated. But the hospital didn't have any cages big enough for the snake. So he just brought it home to our place and we rehabilitated it at our house. So I remember we would take it into the backyard and I would, you know, kind of get on its back and just ride it in the backyard. This is all in Charlotte at the time. And so that was my first exposure. Mom blames my love of snakes on dad, but he would always say, no, I didn't encourage him. I just didn't discourage him. Dad, of course, loves snakes as much as I do. And so when we were younger, whenever we'd go hiking, camping, if we found a snake while out and about, then yeah, Dad would catch it and talk about it. And, you know, in the backyard, if a black rat snake was in the backyard, then, again, he would catch it. I remember my neighbor screaming, I think I was around 4 or 5, my neighbor screaming. And so I ran over to her yard and there was a rough green snake. And I remember pinning it and bringing it back to Dad and talking about the rough green snake. And all these times, you know, Mom is deathly afraid of snakes, was at the time. And so we would usually be allowed to keep it for a week or 2 weeks, and then we'd have to let it go. It wasn't until I think I was around 11 that I was able to convince Mom to let me keep a pet snake, like, permanently.
Okay.
And then I think it was when I was 12. So, yeah. When I was 11, I convinced her I could have a pet snake. And then when I was 12, I think I had 80 pet snakes. So that was my my exposure. And I remember giving, I'm sure many of us were in this boat, but whenever I was in, I think starting second grade, obviously for show and tell, I would always bring in snakes and use that for my show and tell. And the teachers would eventually ask me to give talks to all the other second grade classes. Then you go to third grade, same thing. Hey, can you give this talk to all the other third graders? So it became a point where every year, whatever grade I was in, I would then give a talk to the entire fourth grade class, the entire fifth grade class, et cetera, all the way to high school. And then by high school, you're not only giving it to all the seniors, you also go into the juniors, the sophomores, and the freshmen. And during the same time, I'd also give talks to Boy Scout groups, Lions Club people, Masons, whatever.
Nice.
So my entire life has been kind of public education, I guess.
Yeah, education-based.
Yeah, just trying to convert people from, because also I worked at Dad's veterinary hospital. So we would often have little pets symposia, or I don't even remember what they called. I think they called it like pet parade or something like that.
Okay.
And so I'd bring out my tarantula and I'd bring out my snakes. And when you're faced with the big public like that, a lot of the public wants to say, of course, you know, they want to say, oh, I killed a snake last week, or, oh, you should have heard about my friend that got chased by a water moccasin and blah, blah, blah. The only good snake is a dead snake. And so you get to the point where you learn how to try to convert people. And, you know, early in my career, as in before my career even started, I learned that if you're trying to convince somebody, convert them from a snake hater to maybe just tolerating them, you definitely don't take a confrontational attitude. And of course, most people know that on the internet by now, but in these days, you know, internet was in its infancy. So I kind of figure out how to talk to people about without being overly pushy or overly bearing, or, you know, jumping on their beliefs to the point where they don't even want to listen to what I want to say. So as long as you can get your words in without them getting offended, then sometimes you can get your foot in the door to the point where you can open the door a little bit further and maybe make some change. And as I'm sure all of us have as well, I've made several changes in lots of people's lives, from being snake haters to snake lovers.
Yeah.
So that was just how I got into herping. As far as the book goes, which, you know, I'm working on my second book now, and that should be done this year. in a couple of months.
Yeah, I heard you mention that on Venom Exchange Radio. I listened to that episode. You're working on, it's a book about some venomous snakes, right?
Yeah, the venomous snakes of China.
Right.
So that was originally supposed to be the the first book. I remember when I was still a grad student, I started, you know, putting down the skeleton draft of what I was calling, you know, the venomous snakes of southeastern China. And in my first contract at the university, it said that I needed to write one book. And so this is, we're talking about summer of 2020 now. So it's the COVID years, the beginning of the COVID years. And I'm approaching the end of my contract. Yeah, my first contract ended October of 2020. It was October of 2017 to October 2020. So I'm still pretty far away from finishing my venomous book. And my contract stipulates that I need to have a book. So for whatever reason, I thought about the rat snakes. Oh, I remember exactly the reason. One of my favorite books growing up was called A Rat Snakes Guide, A Hobbyist and Kin to Rat Snakes and Kin, or something like that. Let me see. Let me try to pull it up. Actually, when my book got reviewed, one of the reviewers even noted that he thinks I took inspiration from that, which I did. I think it's called A Hobbyist Guide to Rat Snakes and Kin, or to Elaphe and Kin. It's a really, really good book. And it was, you know, done maybe in 93, 94. Yeah. Rat Snakes, A Hobbyist Guide to Elaphe and Kin. And so I really like that book because not only did it have a lot of information about natural history and everything like that. Do you have it?
I just purchased this book. Yeah. So I haven't gotten a chance to really go through it yet. I literally just purchased it. Yep.
Yep. but it also talks about the net or how to care for them in captivity. And I like books that don't just talk about natural history. I like books that tell us, you know, a lot of us go back and forth between keeping snakes or just appreciating them in nature. It's usually a growing phase. Back in the day, you know, I kept 80 snakes, but now I only have a few. But what I really don't like is how some books will not provide information on how to, let's say, care for an animal because they think that providing that information will encourage people to collect that animal, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, the flip side of that is, let's say somebody is out there catching some kind of rare species that hasn't been kept very well in captivity. Somebody else out there does have the information for keeping that species successfully in captivity. If that person then doesn't know how to care for that and that snake dies, maybe they say, okay, I'm going to try again. And they might do that until they finally get successful after the 10th attempt. Whereas if they had the book that the one guy who has kept that species and provided the information, then that very first animal that that person collected could have been kept successfully. And maybe he could have caught a female and started breeding them and then, you know, started providing animals to the pet trade. Thus saving those 8 other animals that were collected and probably died as well. So, you know, there's a ton of benefit for providing natural history information and captive care information, not only from the well-being of the animals, but also from a conservation viewpoint.
Yeah.
So I kind of modeled my book after that idea. And I figured since my rat snake book was nowhere near finished, I was like, oh, you know, there's only 19 rat snakes. Based on how quickly I've done the venomous, I was like, I can probably knock this out in a month or two. That wasn't the case, but I did knock it out faster than I've knocked out the venomous book.
Okay.
So that was my reason for doing the rat snake book.
Gotcha. No, and, you know, I like I said, I thoroughly enjoy this book. Flipping through it, I wouldn't say I've read it like in full detail cover to cover, but some of the species I'm especially interested in, I've definitely given some greater focus to. But no, I do like how you include some captive care, and I know you had some help from Matt, especially with pictures and stuff, so I'm sure he was able to provide some experience that you were able to lend into there.
Pretty much 50% of that book was by Matt, like all the captive stuff with Matt. Like if I didn't have Matt on board with that book, it would be probably half the size.
Gotcha.
I mean, and that's the other thing, like that I see the benefit of getting information from the captive husbandry aspect is like the rhino rat snakes. We don't have any photos or knowledge of what the juveniles eat in the wild. So if you're just trying to approach it from a strictly natural history viewpoint, or
there's nothing.
Yeah. I would just have to leave that section blank. Whereas at least now we can say, okay, in captivity, they feed on fish. So chances are in the wild, they either feed on fish or tadpoles. So you can glean information that would maybe take decades to get in the natural world.
Yeah, definitely. And it is like amazing to me. And maybe, I don't know, maybe from your perspective, it's not just how much there isn't known about some of these species, and some of them are quite common in the trade, and like, you know, like you said, there's just not a lot of natural history information on them. Would you say that that's because of, I don't know, like not having enough people in China putting the work in to like find information on these species or find them in the wild, or what would you say might be the cause for some of that?
So herpetology and herpetoculture is now just starting to get really, really big in China. Like it's exploded in the past 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
But a lot of almost every single thing that is exploding in China is not native. So I think technically almost all the natives are off limits. Technically speaking, you're not supposed to breed or keep native species, but
I believe I've heard that as well.
Yeah, but non-natives are perfectly fine, which I don't think that's a very good idea, because you know I don't want a Burmese python problem
happening.
And I think it's just could happen any day now. Like you see the number of Florida kings, California kings, corn snakes, garter snakes, indigos, rattlesnakes that are here in China. If a really big king snake gets loose, you know, who knows? A lot of the natural history in captive care for the native species isn't super out there like it is in Western books. It might be getting more and more out there. Because there are still some people that do breed the native species. But any books that they're doing, they're going to be making them in Chinese. So that's also going to make it difficult for anybody that doesn't read Chinese. Like a lot of them, there were a couple of people that I had to contact on some of these species, like the Eupreopis perlaceus, the pearl banded rat snake, which is like a related to mandarin rats. There's one guy out in Chengdu who's bred them, so I got all my information from him.
Gotcha.
And then I don't know if you saw what kind of sucked about the timing of the publication of that book. So I published that in March of 2021, and then that summer four new rat snakes came out in China. Four new rat snakes were described.
Okay.
And one of them, let me find the image and I'll see if I can Can I?
Yeah, if you can message it to me on Instagram, okay. I could probably pull it up.
It's an amazingly cool species. So one of the things I really hate these days about a lot of new species is, you know, most of them, when somebody describes a new species these days, it's something that was already there that, you know, has a scale difference or a pattern difference.
Well, I find it funny what you just did with the scale difference, because that was going to be one of my questions I was going to ask you, is what have you thought about some of these taxonomy things that have occurred over the last few years, especially with Gonyosoma, which, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the biggest one.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't.
Well, not even just that. And I just learned yesterday that they've now split like everything. There was a recent paper that came out at the end of 2024, put rhinos back into Rhynchophis.
I had heard about that. It's so annoying.
Now, Procinum and Coerulium are two separate things, and they're in their own genus. So there's that. Then Frenatum is somewhere, and then Oxys and Jance and I were left like untouched.
Okay. Wow. I'm not surprised in the least. It's super annoying. And it's one of the reasons why I hate jumping on any kind of taxonomy bandwagon. And I was even reluctant. Let me open my book and make sure I did this.
Sure. For anyone who has the book, you could follow along.
All right, so maybe I didn't do it on Gonyosoma. I kind of did. So if you're like, look at page 129, that's the rhino rat.
Yep.
You know, scientific name, Gonyosoma, formerly Rhynchophis.
Yes, yep.
And if you then were to go to any of the beauty snakes, which a couple years ago were Orthriophis. So like the Mohlendorphs, the beauty snakes, Cantor's rat snake, all of them were in Orthriophis.
Yeah.
But they've now gone back to a Laffy. So what I hate is, you know, for years we might have a stable name, and then somebody puts out a paper that says, okay, this is a new genus. And then 2 years later, somebody says, nope, you know, this paper is wrong and it's actually back to where it should have been. And so I hate all this flip-flopping. And so it makes me very reluctant to accept any kind of change unless it has been stable for, like, let's say 10 years. So like,
right.
Pantherophis in the U.S., that's now Pantherophis. I'm fine with calling that.
Yeah.
But back when they first suggested it, I was very pissed off about it. But it's been stable. Nobody has ever said, yeah, these guys should actually be a Laffy again. Here, I found this picture. And so this one, the one in 2021, this one was a legit brand new snake. And when I saw it, when my friend sent me a picture, because he's the one that found it,
okay,
I was like, holy shit. So let me also send you another picture about what makes this one so cool, because I don't know how much you know about venomous snakes. Are you pretty big on venomous?
Not much, I'll be honest. My venomous okay. knowledge is lacking. So I'm looking at this. This is called a Laffy Zyphodonta.
Yeah, Zyphodonta. Yeah. Which means, I think it means different tooth, maybe.
Okay.
And
that's cool.
If you look at this one,
It's a very small Wikipedia page.
Yeah. Internet's slow because I also typically have to run a VPN to access.
Oh, no worries. Good.
So in the mountains where this one is found, there's a viper, and this is basically a mimic, and it's mimicking the viper.
Okay.
And that's what I'm trying to pull up a picture of. Actually, let me just send you an image that I took instead of the internet.
Sure. Blade toothed rat snake. That's interesting. Yeah,
blade toothed rat snake. And as soon as I saw the snake, I told him he should call it, I'll send you the name, Geranoides is what I said. I was like, oh, I hope you call it that. But he said the name had already been submitted, so he didn't get a chance to.
Gotcha.
To call it. So Oides, if you know any Latin or Greek, like Lampropeltis, you know, the Scarlet King, Oides means looks like or resembling. Okay. And so the snake that bit me in 2012. Hopefully, since this is pre-recorded, you can cut out any dead space like this.
Yeah, I can. Or I can probably work it a little bit.
Okay, good. All right, so I just sent you a JPEG. It's
okay.
You got a little bit of cough too.
Yeah, I always have the lingering cough. I feel fine.
The original's too big, so I'm just going to send a screenshot of it.
Okay, that's fine.
Let's try that. Okay, did that go through?
Yes. Okay.
All right, so that right there is the viper. And then, of course, you got that rat snake up there. And they live in the exact same habitat.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the viper. And then the other is basically a mimic of that viper right there.
Got it. That's cool.
And having a rat snake that mimics a viper is just really not very common. And this is just something completely brand new. Like, there's never been another snake that looks anything like this in China. So that was a legit brand new snake.
Yeah, I find that so interesting that, like, you know that it's just like brand new out of nowhere, right? I mean, yeah. That's so cool about nature.
Chances are people had been seeing it for years and everybody thought it was the viper. And so they would just, the locals would just run away from it. And eventually a herpetologist got into the area and he didn't run away from it. So.
Gotcha. Interesting. Yeah. And now, let's see. Well, another interesting thing that people should know is that the book is also in Chinese. It's like dual language, which I think is very cool.
I'm not going to do that with the Venomous book, though.
You're not.
It's going to be too big. It's already going to be about 1,000 pages.
Oh, wow.
So if I then added Chinese, it would probably make it 1,500 pages.
Wow. So okay.
Just English.
Very cool. One section I found particularly fascinating, and especially because I like the species a lot, is the Porphyresia section.
That's my favorite one.
Yeah. And just seeing how much, like, how many different types that have been named over the years and what's actually out there. And because of what I keep, I have some Guangxi province Volantii from Matt. I have them from Matt, but you know, I notice in there's a lot of those subspecies names that look quite similar to Volantii. They all just kind of look very similar. I'm curious as to, like, just what's going on there, or like how have they been distinguished over the years? And I don't know how much you actually know about it besides what's in the book.
Porphyraceous is what we call a clusterfuck of a complex, basically. there's multiple complexes like that in China, and that's one of them. You know, the fact that I think at one point there was 9 subspecies described, and then it just goes back and forth.
Crazy number.
Yeah. And most people don't seem to know how to distinguish one subspecies from another. Like, for a while, Nigra fasciata and Volantii were basically identical as far as like the description goes. Or, you know, it might be a subcaudal difference, maybe.
Okay.
So that was both fun and not fun, having to do all this kind of research on all these different subspecies. Right. And of course, when I made that distribution map of the subspecies, trying to actually delineate where the different subspecies are is also really difficult because, well, another thing that I hate about current taxonomy is most taxonomists these days don't believe in the subspecies unit. Most people, taxonomy wise, would say it's only species. There's no such thing as a subspecies.
I've heard that before.
You know, before the one of the other big taxonomy changes in the U.S. that I really hated was, or I think it still is in effect, when they split up the Alaphe obsoleta, the Pantherophis complex.
I keep Texas rats, so I know what you're talking about.
You know, now we have Eastern rat, Midland rat, and Western rat.
Yep.
But you look at the eastern ones and you see a black rat snake, you see a yellow rat, you see an Everglades rat, you see a Texas rat, you know, you can see the differences. But, you know, they're trying to say a black rat from the mountains of North Carolina is identical as a yellow rat from, you know, Lake Okeechobee or Ocala, Florida, without any differences whatsoever, basically, other than visual. So a lot of people don't like subspecies, and so I'm here trying to delineate the ranges of the subspecies. So even though people don't like subspecies, people won't even kind of note, you know, that this is the subspecies. Instead, on lists of localities, they'll just give it at the species level. So it's kind of difficult to draw this map, and I would love to go to all these different spots where you have the different contacts between the supposed subspecies and try to, you know, make this a little bit more accurate, more clean.
Right.
You know, you have that big area where there's the green and the red with all those cross markings.
Yeah, which is kind of like unknown, or
an integrate zone, but I would love to do more, and I really want to do more with the porphyraceous complex, and that's one of my projects I'm hoping to do. Just whenever I can find the time. But yeah, there's a lot of variation. And that's kind of why I made this species entry so much longer. And I really enjoyed the maps on 157 and 158.
Yeah.
You know, showing what all the juveniles look like. Yeah.
Just try to show a little bit of a visual. One thing I did find particularly interesting about this map, because I was reviewing it before we did this tonight, like I was mentioning, so I have the Guangxi Valanti from Matt, but there's actually there are no arrows on this diagram that actually, unless I'm mistaken of where Guangxi is, and I think I looked at it on the map correctly, there are no arrows that point directly to it. And Matt had even alluded to me that he thinks they might be a separate subspecies or their own thing. as opposed to just straight Valanti.
There is no map. Let me see. Let me look at this image. Okay. All right. If you're looking at 157.
Yep.
And you look at specimen I in the bottom.
Okay.
It's pointing to northern Vietnam.
Right.
So the... just to the right of that border, that's Guangxi.
Right. Okay. So I did have that right. Yep. Okay.
And so, yeah, there's a Hainan, an arrow to Hainan. There's an arrow to northern Vietnam, but there's no arrow, which would basically be between that.
Right.
And part of that was because I don't have, other than Matt's animals, which he just has to take the word of whoever he got them from, that they're from Guangxi. Right. But I wanted pictures of specimens that were found at those locations.
Oh, of course, of course.
I don't have any Guangxi animals.
Gotcha.
Images of Guangxi animals. I've never found them in Guangxi.
Okay.
But,
got it.
Can I grab some more coffee?
Yeah, of course. Go for it.
Just to help my throat.
No problem. All right. So one of the things I wanted to ask you too, just, you know, for the, like the fun of it, in writing this book, what would you say is, like, out of the entire Asian rat snake family, which species do you think is, like, an unsung hero per se, like one that maybe doesn't get a lot of recognition, whether in the, herpetoculture or just in general of
I think Mullendorfs are really, really awesome.
Yeah.
I will try to find a picture of my wife with one. We met a friend in Hong Kong recently.
Okay.
And he's holding like a 14-year-old Mullendorf, and it's just massive.
Oh yeah.
Mullendorfs I really love. Korean rat snakes, which, you know, actually they're not technically Korean rat snakes because they don't live in Korea. And my friend is putting out a book that should be out this year, the Herps of Beijing, and in that he's calling them Chirfung rat snakes because they're That's the locality. But so page 47. And it's also the one on the cover. So,
got it.
You know, the Korean rat, I think they're just, they have so much variation. And, you know, they're related to Russian rats. And I don't know if you ever tried to keep a Russian rat, but Russian rats are awesome also. They're kind of like, you know, they're kind of like a king snake, but they're a rat snake.
Right.
Eastern king, you know.
Yeah. No, I haven't had the pleasure of having a Russian.
They're massive, you know, easily 6 feet, thick, strong snakes. Let me see if I can find this picture of Daisy with the Mollendorfs.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say those are kind of the, I think, overlooked.
Okay.
Because, you
another
know, a lot
one,
of people...
No, go ahead.
Well, a lot of people would say the that elegant rat snake in the bottom right-hand corner of the back of the cover, which,
yep.
Of course, they're gorgeous, but, you know, it's another tricolor.
Yeah.
Here we go.
One group of snakes that I wish we could have more of in herpetoculture that I think would be popular just in reading, you know, flipping through the Klaus book is the entire Colignathus genus. And I know you only highlighted the radiated rat in here, but there's so much in there and so much diversity and colors, and they just look super, super impressive.
They have a lot of personality too, and they have a lot of really interesting behaviors. You know, like they play dead. Like, you don't think of many rat snakes that do that,
right?
But they'll play dead. They'll play dead really fast, actually. And all their a lot of their neck displays are, it's vertical, kind of like a like a Drymarchon, indigo.
Yep.
They flatten vertically. And I guess a lot of Goniosoma flattens vertically too.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had people on here who have bred the, I guess, the common trinkets, Helena, Colignathus Helena, but I don't think most of the others we can get here in the US hobby. Because
there's
of
a
where
really
they are.
Pretty one. There's a really pretty one from Thailand. I just sent you the picture of my wife with the big Mollendorfs.
Oh, wow.
Let's see.
Let's pull that up.
That was 2019.
Yeah, Mollendorf are just such an impressive snake.
Yeah. So
I'd love to keep them.
And Matt was telling me, you know, because one of the things that's really cool about them, of course, is, you know, they hunt bats. And they'll crawl on the ceiling of the caves.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's bred them. He mentions the eggs are like crazy hard. Not hard as in difficult, but hard as in literally they're hard. The eggs are hard.
Yeah.
And he, I guess, has to kind of help the juveniles. But he says it has way more calcium in it than any other rat snake egg.
Yeah, super interesting.
So when we were in Thailand in 2019, we found a Coelenathus, I think it's Flavoviridus. No, not. It's Flavo, maybe Flavolineatus, yellow line.
Okay.
Let's see if I can find the picture real quick. Gorgeous, gorgeous rat snake.
Yeah.
So I would think. Yeah. I would think that could be made it, you know, because we have a lot of Thailand. The U.S. has a lot of Thailand.
True.
Species.
True.
Yeah, cocci comes to mind.
Yeah, I have some cocci here.
Really?
Yeah.
So I kind of think that cocci is probably a different species.
You like, do?
Yeah, I do. And that's one of the things I'm trying to work on. When I mentioned working on the Porphyracea complex.
Interesting.
Because I think I would like to describe it as a... Because when you look at... Let's see. Go to the Porphyraceous section.
Sure.
The book. And go to page 162.
Okay.
What I try to illustrate on this picture is that's the primary subspecies. Newly hatched, straight out of the egg, subspecies. All of them are banded, except for Coxsi. And
that is true.
And the other thing I try to mention with all the other previous pages is, you know, most of the juveniles of the banded ones, they're banded as juveniles, but as adults, the banding usually fades and it turns into some dorsal stripes on some,
or they go through some form of genetic change, minus Coxsi, really.
And the other thing that I think gives credence to them being their own thing, if you look at page 156, which is the one of all the different subspecies.
Yeah.
You'll notice every single one has a pretty big range, except for Coxsi.
Yeah, and I was curious about that. It is the one that's like, I won't call it the most south, but it's under that like scatter of like pink dots, right? It's that small, three blue dots.
Yes, yeah, that's Coxsi.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's the only place where you can find that species.
Really? It's that small of an area?
Yep.
Wow.
Okay. So, like, when you think about a species complex, especially something with subspecies, typically, and you look at the distribution of this species, you know, all the way from central China, pretty far north, all the way down to, you know, Indonesia, all the as far west as Nepal, as far east as Taiwan. So you know that this species, kind of like the common king snake species with a whole bunch of subspecies, or the common rat snake species with a whole bunch of subspecies, you have a huge range, and inside that range you have different subspecies, as we like to call them. And when you think about it in a U.S. equivalency, looking at common kings or common rats, you know, black rats, yellow rats, eastern king, black king, whatever subspecies you want to look at, most of them have a pretty big range before they run into the next variation.
Right.
But you look at that subspecies, the Coxsi subspecies, and it's tiny. It's only in that one little area. And so I think that is kind of giving it credence for not being a subspecies, but being a species. So I want to get some more DNA from those guys and compare them to a lot of the other populations.
So I know nothing when it comes to taxonomic, like naming and how that process goes, but would it still be under Oreo cryptophis?
Yes.
And then, okay.
Same genus, different species.
Got it. Super interesting.
Okay, I'm doing a screenshot of this Flavolineatus, I think it is.
Sure.
Send that. So you can tell me if you've ever seen these guys in the U.S. pet trade. It's been forever since I've been any shows. I try to avoid shows because if I go to a show, I'm going to want to buy something. So it's best to just avoid them. Avoid the temptation for me.
Okay, are these, what are they? Call them. I'm trying to think of the common name. I think I know.
I mean, it's type slipping. Of trinket.
Yeah, it's slipping my mind. Black copper rat snakes, I think they call them.
Okay, so you've seen these guys in the pet trade?
Not much, but I know they're out there.
Good. I think
people have them, but very, very limited. Yeah, I believe that's what most people, like the common name they're kind of given are the black copper rats. Someone please in the comments correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, super cool. Let's see if there is anything else I wanted to particularly highlight about the book.
I'll probably end up doing the second edition next year. Maybe I can get this year, I don't know. But the second edition will probably be an additional 12 species.
Okay.
So one of the complaints I had about this book was, you know, I call it, and again, I was taking inspiration off that one book, the Hobbyist Guide to a Laffian Kin. And right. In that book, they are only treating the rat snakes. Anything that was ever an Alaffy is the subject of that other book. So, and that's kind of what I like. You know, you take out all the name changing, just boil it back to, I don't know, 1970s when everything that was rat snake was Alaffy.
Yep.
So that's kind of my idea here for using that term and kin.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were expecting me, when they saw the title, they were expecting me to throw in members of the Tias genus. Because their common name is rat snake. Like,
yes.
Indian rat snake. I forget what are the... Indo-Chinese rat snake, common rat snake. But they're more like a racer. So, and they've never been part of a Laffy. So when I think of them, I don't think of them as rat snake. I think of them as a racer. And okay. So a lot of people were expecting those guys to be in here. And I was like, all right, fine. You know, second edition, I'll throw in the new rat snakes that were described, and I'll throw in the Tias.
Does that include the good old Gonyosoma hyenensis?
Oh, God. That's one where I was like, you can't be serious. Like, it's basically the lack of a postocular stripe and an extra loreal scale, I think.
Yeah, the lack of a loreal scale. It's one or the other. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was ridiculous when I read about that one. So, you know, that's an example of you can judge the how much weight I give that species.
You know, it's funnier hearing things like that from you who studies this stuff and from people like Dr. Loafman, when you guys can give genuine scientific opinion on it rather than us just casual, you know, snake breeders who are just like, oh, that's stupid or whatever. But yeah.
Well, at least Zach has a genetics background. I do not have a genetics background. So, you know, whenever these papers come out, you know, I'll look at the animal and make my judgment based on morphology and natural history. But then there'll be the genetics part of the paper, and I can't follow that. So I don't know if they are doing good science or bad science when it comes to the genetics. You know, occasionally I'll send it to a friend who is a genetics person. And I'll say, you know, read this paper, you know, tell me if the genetics aspect of this paper, you know, holds any water or not. But me, I don't know genetics. So whenever I'm doing my stuff for new frogs, you know, I'll do the morphology, I'll do the bioacoustics, and then I send the genetics to somebody else to do.
Okay, gotcha.
It's interesting, but it's too complicated. I have enough complicated stuff to deal with.
Yeah, gotcha. Obviously, so you're into, you know, venomous snakes too, and being in China, you know, I've learned there's just so many species out there in Asia in general, between all the vipers and pretty much everything there. But when it comes to like herping and doing what you do, what's some of like your favorite stuff to find or favorite, I'd say general locations kind of to go looking for animals in the field?
When it comes to China, I'm trying to pull up a search. exit the full screen. Southeastern corner of China is amazing. And I'm going to show you exactly what I mean when I say southeastern corner. I still have yet to go to a lot of other South Asian countries. I'll probably be going to Laos this year, probably the Philippines this year. I've never been to Indonesia yet. I really need to go. I want to go to, you know, Komodo. But Southeastern Asia definitely is just crazy abundant with diversity. And if you're just talking about China by itself, then the southeastern corner of China is also crazy abundant. And
I don't know if you've ever watched Rupert's, I believe it's Rupert's Reptiles on YouTube. I've seen a lot of his herping videos, and he goes all over in Asia, and that's where I really got a glimpse of, like, wow, like, this is such an amazing diversity of what you could find, and just the amount of animals they find is absolutely insane.
Yeah, Rupert has a really awesome gig with his tours that he does.
Yeah, yeah.
He, you know, I think he was basically the very first one to start those things, and he is definitely the best at doing it. And yes, if you simply look at Southeastern Asia, the amount of diversity is crazy. And you can go anywhere in Southeastern Asia and just spend a lifetime.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
So, okay, I just found the reference. Let me take a screenshot. So when I go about, when you ask about favorite places for me, for without going internationally, with just staying inside China,
right?
It's going to be this area. And this was the original plan for the Venomous book.
I was going to say, yeah, that was what you were. I believe you said it was going to originally be titled, and then you were like, well, there's not that many other species outside of this, so let's just do them all.
That was a mistake. I should have stuck with the Southeast. It would have been done by now if I'd stuck with the Southeast.
Gotcha. Pulling this up. Okay.
So that square, you know, in the northwestern corners where... is Hubei province and Shenyangjia, where I, you know, cut my teeth in China back in 2006. Then you go all the way east to Taiwan, you go all the way south to Hainan and Hong Kong. Like, if you just focus on this area right here, then you're going to get probably about 75% of the venomous snakes of China, or even of the 75% of the snakes of China.
Gotcha. And you live whereabouts on this map, generally?
See in the upper right-hand corner where it says Hefei? Go up. Up. Left.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Now go up to the red line.
Okay.
And then over a little bit.
To the left?
No. Sorry. Other side. East. A little bit more. There you go. Stop.
Gotcha.
That's Nanjing.
Yep, okay. Right, got it. Oh, okay. So I see the small label there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm on the northern end of where everything gets boring. Like, from where I am in north, it's boring. Anytime I want to go anywhere and see anything, I have to leave Nanjing and usually go south.
Gotcha. It's super cool.
Another favorite place that Daisy and I went to last month in January that I have forgotten how much I loved it is Thailand. Thailand is amazing, not only for the herps, but just the climate, the people, the food, the environment, the diversity, the size of the country. Like, right. Thailand's I had forgotten how much I loved Island. And I think we're going to try to figure out maybe in the next 5-10 years if there's a way to live in Thailand instead of China.
Oh, but wow.
Thailand is amazing. So if you've never been and you need to go to one single southeastern country, I would recommend Thailand.
Gotcha. I've never been in the eastern hemisphere, so I need to get myself over there.
It's pretty unique.
Yeah.
It's definitely fun.
Yeah.
Definitely fun.
Now, especially, I mean, I just love, you know, all the, like, I'm a very big fan of the Asian rat snake, so I'd love to even get over there to see what kind of herping I could do. And I know it's not, that's very saying that, like, at surface level, like, it's a pretty big undertaking. Like, it's not, you know, because you're really out there, and I know it could get, like, remote and stuff, but that's something I'd love to do eventually.
Yeah, well, really, if you decide to come to China, let me know. And I can help as much as possible.
Awesome. And now your work at the university consists, you were mentioning frogs. Is that what your main focus is?
No, my main focus is snakes, but looking for snakes, I accidentally find new species of frogs. So I've had to become experts on the frogs in order to describe them. But every single time I found a new frog, it was while I was looking for snakes.
Gotcha. That's cool.
So, yeah, snakes are a passion. Frogs are cool too, but snakes, I prefer snakes.
Oh, yeah. You know, it just seems so interesting because I mean, there's so much, I feel like more so than, like, especially anywhere here in the US, like in Asia, it just seems so much more like remote and unexplored land where I'm sure it's just teeming with stuff that us humans have never found before. And obviously you're doing that, but I'm sure even more so than what's already been found.
I mean, yeah, and that's exactly why I ultimately accepted the position, was because when the U.S. university was doing the job interview and I was even considering them, I said, when they were giving me my workload, I was like, okay, well, I'm at least going to have summers off to go back to China and do my research in China, right? I'm like, oh, no, you're not going to have time for summer vacation. You're going to be doing summer classes. So that kind of helped convince me, you know, no way am I going to do that. But and the other reason I wanted to do work in China is simply here you can still find new stuff. Like everything's been done in the U.S. Like I can't go anywhere in the U.S. We find a new species in the U.S. once a decade, maybe. And that's usually a split from something that was already well known. But in Asia, you go out looking for snakes and then you accidentally find, you know, new frogs. Not even looking for the frogs. So it's just so much more of that exploration lifestyle, or it's so much more exciting, it's so much more mysterious. It's so cool to go to a place and see something and not know, like, you know, what is this? To have that sense of the unknown, whereas anywhere in the U.S. you go, you're going to know what it is, you know, for the most part, other than, like, you might be some kind of skink that you need to determine which kind of skink it is.
Right.
Here, I just sent you another picture of a Gonia Selma that we found in Borneo.
Oh, that's very August. Cool. Yeah. Let's pull that up. Nice. Yeah, it's a great looking animal too.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun. No complaints. Yeah.
And now, just out of pure curiosity, I'm sure when you fully moved to China, I'm sure it was a bit of a culture shock. How did you learn to kind of assimilate? And obviously, you had work to do. But like, how did you learn to kind of embrace a totally new culture?
A little bit easier for me since I would do, you know, summers. So as a grad student, I would come for spring semester would end, fly to China, May, June, July, August, be in China, come back to the US. Gotcha. For the fall semester. So for me, I was able to have a little 3 to 4 month exposure back to the US, 3 to 4 months back to the US. So I got to be able to get used to it. It's not like just jumping, in the deep end and getting immersed without previous exposure. So it's easier for me, I think, than a lot of other people. But once I moved here completely full time, then yeah, there's still some more getting used to situations. But there's no more, at that point, there's no more culture shock that I had to deal with. So,
okay.
It was pretty easy to transition. And now it's actually gotten kind of the point where I kind of view China as a home. Whereas, you know, in the past, like in 2017, when I accepted the position, I still went back, of course, to the U.S. for the winter holidays. And that's what I've been doing every winter since. And it would kind of feel like, oh, it's nice to be back home, back in the U.S. You have that sense of home. But now, whenever I leave the U.S. and come back to China, I also kind of have that same sense of, oh, you know, it's great to be back home in China.
Like, gotcha.
When I would be in the U.S. during the COVID years, I was missing China. I was like, I really couldn't wait to get back, not only, you know, to see my girlfriend at the time, now wife, but I was also missing the food. I was missing the culture. I was missing the herping. You know, I appreciated the time I was spending in the U.S., but I also wanted to be back in China. So yeah. It's really the best situation is being able to dip your feet in both places. But, you know, that's expensive flying back and forth.
Right.
Multiple times.
Of course. Gotcha. And you had mentioned before you were still keeping some snakes. You do still keep some stuff.
In the U.S.? In the U.S., my dad and I have two snakes.
Okay.
My dad has a 20, let's see, this is 2025. So he has a 24-year-old corn snake.
Okay.
And I hatched it in 2001. It had a spine deformity. The mother was wild. I was doing a pit tag program in South Carolina. Caught the mother. She laid eggs. I incubated the eggs. 10 of the babies were normal. 2 of the babies had a spinal deformity. So I released the 10 healthy babies, and I found homes for the 2 that had the spine deformity. And then one of those friends moved up north and she couldn't take the corn snake with her. So she gave it back to me. And then I gave that corn snake to dad. And so he still has that corn snake. So that corn snake is now 24 years old. And then in 2013, when I was a grad student in Alabama, I came across, let me see if I can find this picture. A naturally occurring hybrid between a black king and a mole king.
Okay.
And I've been wanting to do genetics on it to prove it's a hybrid, but nobody's ever taken me up on it. So let me show you a picture and how I came to the belief that it's a hybrid. So I still have him. So he's a hybrid king.
Very nice.
And I still have him. So he was in 2013. So he's, you know, 10 years old now. Made a little graphic that I put on Flick. And then here in China, nothing yet.
Okay.
But I'll probably be getting, because we do some nature programs, my wife and I. Okay. So we'll probably get some nice snakes that you can hand around to kids. Maybe a beauty snake.
Nice.
maybe a Korean rat snake. Maybe a Dionysus rat snake.
Got it. Yeah, I was going to ask, does like captive keeping and breeding like interest you anymore? Is it really more so finding stuff in the wild?
I mean, I still definitely love to, if I have the space, I would love to keep a lot of stuff. But whenever I do keep anything, I want it to be in a nice, big, huge, you know, vivarium. I want it to,
right.
I want the enclosure to basically be a piece of the wild, you know, living in my living room or whatever.
Got it.
So if I don't have the ability to do that for whatever animal it might be, then I don't want to keep it.
Understood.
Here we go. Just the, open up the Instagram chat. I love the people that have the ability to make these impressive terrariums that basically look like,
oh yeah,
you're taking a piece of the environment and putting it in your living room, and then that animal gets to, you know, not even realize he's in captivity. Basically, he's just living his life. So yeah, I do want to keep, I would love to keep lots of stuff.
Okay.
I just need more space. Gotcha. Okay. So when I have this, when I made this picture to indicate it was a hybrid, on the bottom row are the three Lampropeltis that live in, right, Huntsville, Alabama. You have your Caligaster, which is a mole king or a prairie king, depending on how far east or west you go. I think from that region of Alabama, I mean, that individual there looks more like a mole king than a prairie king.
Okay. But
either way, he's Caligaster. And maybe even that region of Alabama, it's a intergrade zone. The local Lampropeltis getula is the black king. And so there's what the black kings look like. And then there's, yep, the local milk snake. And then the top, wow, row is the snake that was found in somebody's garage.
Interesting.
And so, you know, it's definitely not a triangulum. There's no triangulum, yeah, in there whatsoever. But, yeah, if you were to count the blotches, you know, he basically has a mixture between the saddles of the common king and the Caligaster. And so he's literally a mixture, in my opinion, between a Caligaster.
And the colors, too. You could kind of see, like, the rustiness,
uh-huh,
type, yeah, color coming through on a rather dark snake that's coming all from the black king, you know?
Yep, yep.
Very cool.
Yeah, so those are the two snakes that I have now. Is
nice.
That hybrid king and then dad's 24-year-old corn snake.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, awesome. Let's see. When it comes to like what is at this point, and in your like career and stuff, like what is your main area of research?
In general, my PhD was on the conservation of, well, it was identifying conservation priority areas in southeastern China. So if, okay, you want to protect an area and get the most bang for your buck, how do you determine which areas those should be? So it was based on a whole number of different criteria, like, you know, you need to have X amount of continuous land. You need to have X number of endangered species in that area. And so, you know, maybe you have a really small area of land and there might be one super endangered species in there. But if you're throwing a whole bunch of money at it, it might be a better idea to look at a different area. And let's say you have another place that's, you know, slightly bigger, but it has, you know, three super endangered species in it. So obviously, right, if your resources are limited, it's better to protect that location than it is the other location.
Got it.
So it was using a whole bunch of different computer programs to determine which places, based on a number of criteria, would be the best bang for your buck to conserve if you're going to protect some land.
Interesting.
So that was the PhD program. And then as I accepted the position and started doing just herp surveys around southeastern China to learn the lay of the land, that's when I started finding all these new frogs. And
got it.
And then I went down the frog trajectory because, you know, whatever gets a paper published is how I continue to make the university happy. So
okay.
So now it's more frogs than it is snakes, but
got it.
Once I'm done with all the frogs, I want to get back to the snake stuff.
Cool. Awesome, man. All right. Awesome. Well, I think that kind of covered what I wanted to talk with you about tonight. I'm sure I'll be able to have you back again in the future to talk about. I've had multiple guests on here about venomous stuff. So when the venomous book comes out, I'd love to have you back on to talk a little bit about that. I'd love to get myself a copy as well. I have a couple wrap up. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm done maybe in hoping to have it ready for the printers by the end of, hopefully by the end of March, but
awesome.
It should hopefully be 100% by the end of April.
Very cool.
Very cool.
All right. Looking forward to it. And you guys, all the listeners should keep your eyes out open for it. And yeah. I have a couple wrap up questions, which are usually a little more tailored to keepers and breeders, but I guess I'll kind of alter them more so for you. But yeah, I guess this one's rather simple, but like, what's a big motivator for what keeps you so interested in reptiles? You've been doing it forever. You've been keeping and been around them forever, but what keeps that fire burning when it comes to reptiles easy for you?
That's easy because every year for the past, I guess, 10 years, maybe, I'm always going to at least one new location and I'm always seeing something new that I've never seen before. So, you know, probably this is March in June, I'll be going to Laos. I've never been to Laos. Okay. And then maybe in July or August, I'll be going to the Philippines. I've never been to the Philippines. So whenever you go to a brand new location and you see a snake, a frog, a lizard that you've never seen before, you get that same excitement that, you know, the first time I went to Arizona, you know, it was amazing. Like everything I saw was brand new. So it's really easy to be energized. And even in China, like there's still plenty of species I haven't found. Like last September, I went road cruising in Yunnan province in the southwest corner of China. And I found three phase vipers at night road cruising. And okay. Prior to that, I'd found six DORs, and you know, then this one night happened, and finally found my living lifer, phase viper, and then later that night, number two, then later that night, number three, the day before that, I got my first baby king cobra, wild Chinese baby king cobra.
Okay.
So, I mean, seeing something new is always rejuvenates you. Like in the US, it's hard for me to get a lifer these days, unless I go maybe northwestern US where it's cold and rainy. But even in China now, it's really rare for me to get a new lifer. But, you know, a baby king cobra was a lifer for me. I found adults. I'd never seen a baby before. And the phase vipers were lifers. So it's easy for me to still get lifers. And I think that kind of helps prevent any kind of burnout.
Nice. Awesome. Cool. I guess you kind of answered this before, but I like asking people, like, what does the future hold for you? Just in terms of, I'd say, like, what you're doing, maybe where your interests lie when it comes to the reptiles. You said potentially a move to Thailand would interest you, but what do you think the future holds for what you're doing with reptiles in general?
Providing nothing happens with Thailand, that's kind of a dream. So let's assume that doesn't happen. I kind of see myself here for the next at least 10 years, still doing the research thing, still doing the university thing. And during that 10 years, because it's too expensive to live in the US. That's another thing, is it's living in Asia is so much easier than living in the US. Like, I could never afford a house in the US. So that's also kind of a downside, but also helps keep me here in Asia. But there's still so much more. Even if I could afford a house in the US, or if I got a job, I would still want to be here in Asia. So I want to still do at least 10 more years here in China before I kind of feel like I have done my job. Like, there's still so many gaps. There's still so much work that I want to do. Once I do that, then I'll feel better about moving on to a new location. Gotcha. Whether or not that's Thailand or Japan or the US or South Africa, I don't know.
Okay. Very cool. And I guess because the gist of this episode was mainly Asian rat snakes, what would you say for any hobbyist who's maybe looking to jump into an Asian rat snake or Chinese rat snake for the first time, whether they've, you know, never kept a colubrid species before? Obviously, this is colubrid corruption, but they've never kept a colubrid before, or they're just getting into reptiles. Why should they go with a Chinese species of rat snake?
There's a couple species that are, you know, just as easy as any kind of corn snake. Snakes are supposed to be super ass easy. You know, they're dog tame. They don't get gigantic.
What was the species you said? It cut out for like a brief second.
Oh, Dionys.
Oh, Dionys. Yeah,
Dionys. You know, in the pet trade, there's a ton of different color variations. Yeah. I didn't put all of them in here. I think I used pretty bland imagery, but I know some people that breed them in Russia that have just crazy color morphs. So Dionys rat snake is probably the closest thing to a corn snake as far as ease. I think the Russian rats, the Korean rats are super easy. You know, I wouldn't recommend a beginner do something like a Mandarin rat or, a beauty rat snake. A beauty rat snake would be a perfect one. So either a Taiwan beauty or any of the Chinese beauties. Yeah. Beauty rat snake, I would probably say. Yeah. Taiwan beauty. Nice. That'd be mine.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, this was a fantastic episode. I really appreciate you coming on again. Thank you so much for making accommodations to our time differences. It's much appreciated. And because this is pre-recorded, I'll just do the kind of outro with you here on the screen. Usually I send people to the background. Also, for anyone who's looking to follow Dr. Messenger on social media, I'll have the link to his Instagram there. So make sure you give him a follow, stay up to date with what he's doing. I'll definitely show off when he's coming out with the book. I'll be on the lookout for that as well. Venomous Snakes of China. Anyone who's listening, thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Kluber Corruption Podcast. This was episode number 55 with Dr. Kevin Messenger, talking about some of the Chinese rat snakes and Asian colubrids and whatnot. Make sure you leave a like on today's podcast. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Leave us a 5-star review on your major audio podcasting platforms. Feel free to join the Meteoric Serpents Patreon. First link in the description below. I also forgot to mention it at the beginning, but again, Kluber Fest this year, September 12th through 14th in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Make sure you guys are up to date with that and come to check it out. Again, thank you to Show Me Reptiles for sponsoring today's episode. And yeah, guys, again, this was episode number 55 of the Kluber Corruption Podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. Have a great rest of your night, and we'll see you on the next one. Peace.